It seems so long ago, doesn't it? Well, almost no one thought Joe Biden could make it back to the White House. Not Donald Trump, not the two dozen Democratic rivals who sought to take down a weak front runner, not the mega donors and key endorsers who feared he could not beat Bernie Sanders, not even Barack Obama. The story of Joe Biden's victory in the 2020 election is the story of a Democratic Party at odds with itself, torn between the single-minded goal of removing Donald Trump and the push for a bold progressive agenda that threatened to alienate as many voters as it drew. In the new book, Lucky, How Joe Biden Barely Won the Presidency, authors Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes use their unparalleled access to key players inside the Democratic and Republican campaigns to unfold how Biden's nail-biting run for the presidency vexed his own party as much as it did Trump. Jonathan Allen is a senior political analyst with NBC News Digital. Amy Parnes is a senior correspondent for The Hill newspaper in Washington, where she covers the Biden White House and national politics. Jonathan and Amy, it's a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for
having us.
All right. Well, Jonathan, let us begin with you of how this book came about. Obviously, I would think you would think going into it, well, either way, the story will be interesting.
Absolutely. And, listeners may be familiar with our last book called Shattered, Inside Right. Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. We knew picking up off of 2016 that this was going to be an incredible race with Donald Trump running for re-election and essentially espousing this theory that he would be able to deepen his base and find more Trump voters, more MAGA voters, and win that way rather than persuading people who are Democrats or independent minded to come toward him. And at the same time, the Democrats were going to have this sort of, this sort of struggle within to figure out what was the best way to come to Trump the second time. All of that played out. We saw the pretty lengthy primary that all of a sudden ended in a snap when probably the most incredible resurrection of a political candidate I've ever seen. A general election that gets played out against the backdrop of a plague that kills, by now more than 500,000 people and protests for racial justice and violence accompanying that. You couldn't make up what we saw in last year's election.
Amy, tell us what you think about at what point did you start to think of this in terms of being lucky? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of political skill here involved, and a lot should be said for the tenacity of Joe Biden. But when do you think luck became the appropriate word?
It's funny because as John and I were writing the book, we kept coming back to it because throughout the campaign, throughout the primary, we kept seeing various things happen. Of course, in Iowa and New Hampshire, he came in fourth and fifth, respectively, but he was having money problems. He couldn't line up key endorsements, as we talked about in the book. He went to people like Al Sharpton and tried to get their endorsement and couldn't lock them in. And at the same time, he's having these strokes of luck. His opponents are actually helping him. One specific example is when Elizabeth Warren takes out Michael Bloomberg in a Nevada debate. At the time, Michael Bloomberg was really gaining traction, and the Biden folks were really worried about him as an opponent and sort of appealing to more moderate Democrats. That happened. And then Clyburn, the endorsement with James Clyburn, the House whip, was sort of, not, it wasn't for certain. And I think that, he really had to work to get it. We talk a little bit about what the concessions were with Jim Clyburn and how he wanted a black Supreme Court justice. And he wanted Biden to kind of talk about that during a debate. And we have a scene in the book when he when Clyburn isn't really hearing what he wants to hear from Biden on the stage during one particular debate and races toward him backstage and tries to get him to talk about the fact that he wants that black Supreme Court justice. So we kept seeing time and again, the stars sort of aligned for him. And we talked to people inside the campaign about that, and they were the first ones to sort of vouch for that idea.
So, Jonathan, when it comes to that endorsement, I mean, the way that we reported on it when the president, when Biden was finally declared the winner of the election, and I mean, none of that was, you know, easy, but okay, but he was finally declared the winner. that
he won.
Yeah, he won. He won. He won.
The title lucky is not to imply any illegitimacy to the election. The election was legitimate. He won. It was certified by state, you know, secretaries of state across the country and the Congress.
He got so lucky that he won those court cases. The Clyburn endorsement really was brought up several times as being the turning point in the campaign. Amy just was talking about it in detail in the scenes in the book, which are fascinating. When you look back on it in the story, is it the real turning point? Is that the point where everything just goes, okay, this is Biden's to lose?
Absolutely, and it sets off so many other things. It's part of it's basically a stopping point where momentum reverses. And, you know, Biden had told people he was going to have to win second place in Nevada. And some of his folks had said he's going to have to come in second in Nevada to have a comeback. And he ends up coming in second in Nevada by, like, the smallest of margins. And he's able to sort of push that into a comeback story. And the press kind of, you know, some of them buy it, some of them don't. Some of the Democratic, luminaries buy it, some of them don't. But then he makes it to South Carolina. He's like, all I wanted to do was get here. And still the Clyburn endorsement isn't a foregone conclusion. He has been asking Clyburn for months to get on board. His co-chairman of his campaign, Cedric Richmond, a member of the Congressional Black Caucus at the time, very close to Clyburn, goes to him in February and says, look, you got to get in now, because if you don't get in now, it's not going to make a difference. This campaign is going off the rails. And Clyburn says, I'm going to wait. And then the story that Amy told you about Clyburn, you know, really wanted to hear Biden say that he would appoint a black Supreme Court justice. That mattered more to Clyburn than a black woman for vice president did, because he thought a Supreme Court justice could have more effect over a longer period of time than a vice president who might serve for only 4 years. So, you know, Clyburn hears Biden say that on the debate stage. And it's the difference between, between Clyburn saying, hey, I'm with Joe Biden, and Clyburn giving this very emotional endorsement that he gives. He talks about his late wife and how much she loved Joe Biden. And it's not that Biden would have lost South Carolina without Clyburn. It's that nobody thinks he would have gotten the margin that he did. He got a huge margin in South Carolina, and that basically sets off this chain reaction where, President Obama, who is reluctant to get behind Biden for two presidential campaigns in a row, gets off the sidelines behind the scenes, starts making phone calls on behalf of Biden, trying to, get other Democrats to endorse him. He taps into Obama's top fundraising guy, taps into the fundraising network for Obama, says now's the time to give to Joe. And you see within a couple of days of that South Carolina primary endorsement by Jim Clyburn, Biden, sweep up on Super Tuesday and essentially on his way to the general election. And then, of course, there's some things in the general election that happened, mainly Donald Trump getting in his own way that really went in Biden's favor.
Let us talk about that, Amy, when we get to the general election, because there were all kinds of concerns about how strong of a candidate Biden would be. Trump was, of course, painting him as out of touch and perhaps even senile and was bunkered in his basement and wasn't leaving but there did seem to be a strategy amongst the campaign of you limit him, you're operating a campaign during a pandemic, you say, look, we're trying to abide by the rules. You make the events safe. You make them very infrequent, really. And all of that ultimately seemed to work to address sort of all of the issues that were coming at the Biden campaign, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, I think going into even before COVID, his aides worried that he has this tendency to make a gaffe or two, or to have a verbal misstep, if you will. And so I think that what the pandemic was able to do was sort of, I mean, he was advocating for people staying home, which he did. And it also allowed him to get off the campaign trail for months at a time and not campaign, and sort of let Trump kind of implode. And we have a detail in the book where Anita Dunn, who is Biden's senior advisor, she essentially tells an associate, COVID is the best thing that ever happened to him. And this is sort of like what they were thinking behind the scenes. Of course, they would never say this publicly, but they did feel like the pandemic sort of worked to his favor, because it made him look presidential while he could kind of stay home and off the campaign trail.
Jonathan, let us talk. It seems that we can't have this discussion without talking about how also important the selection of Kamala Harris was as the vice presidential pick on the Democratic ticket. Give us a sense of what went into that decision. I don't think it was a huge surprise to many people who thought that she was the natural choice and was in many orbits the obvious choice. But what went into that decision for the former vice president?
Well, we report on this deeply in the book, and all the sort of machinations and the various potential candidates for vice president, including Gretchen Whitmer and Stacey Abrams and Susan Rice. And so, you know, you go through that set in the book. But as far as, you know, choosing Kamala Harris, you know, Biden was very upset with her after, and I don't care what they say publicly, what we know privately is Biden and his campaign were pretty upset with her about the about their squabble on the debate stage in 2019, where, you know, she basically portrayed him as the, you know, the senator standing in the schoolhouse door while she was, you know, trying to integrate her elementary school. And so, you know, that was something that stuck with Biden for a long time. He really thought it was an unfair attack on him. And, you know, it almost cost Harris the VP nod, which, as you point out, I think a lot of people saw as her as the obvious pick. There were a couple of reasons for that. You know, some of them were sort of environmental. You know, if you go back into the summer of 2020, you've got these protests for racial justice going on. And, you know, Biden is trying, and we write about this in the book, too. There's a real debate in his campaign about whether he should embrace the slogan defund the police and whether he should apologize for the 1994 crime bill that he wrote. And, you know, he wanted to not go where the activists wanted him to go. And he didn't go there. But what it did is it meant that it was more important for him to choose a vice presidential candidate who is African-American. And that sort of narrowed the field down. And even at the end, he still wasn't 100% sure that Harris was the direction that he wanted to go. But she polled better. She had the resume. You know, in some ways, when it comes to criminal justice issues, she has, you know, she reflected a little bit of where Biden had been, which is, you know, tough on crime as Attorney General of California, even when that made some of her own base unhappy. So, you know, ultimately, she was the obvious pick. She was the one who was least likely to do harm and the one who was able to, you know, probably be able to message, particularly the African-American voters, who are such an important part of the Democratic base, that they would have a seat at the Biden table.
Amy, I find one of the things, by the way, we're talking to Amy Parnes and Jonathan Allen. They are the authors of the new book, Lucky, How Joe Biden Barely Won the Presidency. It's a fascinating new book that is out from Crown. Amy, let's talk for a moment about really the debates. And because, well, the first debate was just, I've never seen anything like it. And I...
Same.
and you're right in the book, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, for all the prep that the Biden team did, I don't think anybody thought it was going to be like that. And yet it was. And in some cases, you know, and then it set the tone for the other debates. And then in the middle of it, the president gets COVID and all this other stuff. So it really is bizarre. And I wonder, does it leave you wondering of, I guess, could Joe Biden have screwed that up? I guess he could have, but what were the concerns that he would have?
He could have, but I think he held his own, and that was sort of what they intended to do with him. And I think going into the debate, as we report in the book, he had prep sessions where aides threw everything they could at him, including his son Hunter, who had made headlines recently. Everything, every kind of skeleton, potential skeleton in his closet, there was nothing that was held back. And so he was ready for anything. And I think Trump sort of had like a very mixed agenda, where some aides were telling him behind the scenes, we report in the book, that he should attack him frequently and often, and or he should also just let Joe Biden talk. And because of Joe Biden's past dealing with a stutter, one aide told Trump that, you know, that could lead to more mistakes and more gaffes, so just to let him speak. So he was hearing all kinds of things from advisors, not a real consistent message. And I think that's sort of what you saw. And I think he ultimately decided that he should come after him hard. And that didn't necessarily work out too well for him.
We were all expecting, Jonathan, I think, whether you were rooting for Joe Biden or not, we were all expecting gaffes along the way, because the president, the now president, former vice president, has a history of gaffes. And yet during the campaign, they were very limited. You report on this, but that doesn't happen by accident, does it?
It doesn't happen by accident. And, you know, this goes back to the, to COVID pushing Biden off the campaign trail, and his, you know, the great value for him with that is that he's able to control his message as a result. He's extremely disciplined. And then on the other side, you've got Trump, who has been portraying, setting such a low bar for Joe Biden's performance. And this goes through the first debate, too. Set such a low bar for Biden's performance. He calls him Sleepy Joe, says he's a gaffe machine, says he, you know, argues that he's, descending into senility. And what you actually see is not Joe Biden doing those things, but as a viewer, what you're watching is Donald Trump doing these briefings on COVID from the podium at the White House, where he says things like people should inject disinfectant to combat the pandemic. And, yeah. You know, I mean, let me just be clear, in case anyone's listening, they should not inject disinfectant. You know, go get the Pfizer vaccine, Moderna vaccine, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Don't get the Mr. Clean version, okay? Like, that's just not a good idea. But what you're watching is, and we go into deep detail on this, what you're watching is President Trump proving that he has difficulty with the facts. He has difficulty with command of what's going on in front of him. And you know, when Biden comes out and says things, it's very limited and it's very controlled. And then in that debate, you kind of saw the same thing. Trump all over the place and Biden in a much more controlled manner, easily exceeding the low bar that Trump set for him.
I mentioned this at the beginning of our conversation, but, you know, this all seems... It all seems so far away, but it wasn't until early December that the race was eventually called, and so I'm curious as to of how history will remember this, because look, it was close, but it wasn't any closer than the race was in 2016. Biden won the popular vote and also did extremely well in the states. It was supposed to be, I guess, because of what President Trump created in saying that he was the true winner of the election, that it kind of altered minds as even to the closeness of the election because of Georgia and Pennsylvania specifically. But when it's all said and done, it isn't that close, and it is it's a decisive win. And I'm just wondering about how the Biden team saw that and how they ultimately got through it, because it was a difficult time for all Americans, I can't imagine what it would have been for the person who seemed to have won the presidency on Election Day 2020.
Yeah, and I think as we report in the book, they knew that the election would be close. They didn't know that it would be this close. And people told us that even on election night. You know, they were trying to portray the fact that they had this, but they didn't really know for a fact. And, you know, I don't even think the vice president at the time, the former vice president, was convinced that he had won. It's an interesting thing, but you know, I think what people always talk about is the 81 million votes that people that supported Biden. And we're always asked, John and I, how can you say barely? And I think what people don't really understand is that it was much closer than 2016. 43,000 votes separated the two, and it could have gone either way. There were a number of factors that could have pushed the election in either direction. And so that is sort of why I think that we called it lucky and why he barely won, because we're basically taking a look at that exact aspect of this. I think that it will be remembered, obviously, for Biden will obviously made history for all of those votes. But Trump actually gained support. You know, everyone thought that he was just going to lock down his base and that would be it. But I think in the end, he was actually able to make inroads with some in the African-American community and with Hispanics. And that will be something that he's remembered for.
And if I could just jump in real quick.
Absolutely.
Here, that 43,000 votes that Amy talked about, we're talking about the difference between the two candidates combined in Georgia, Arizona, and Wisconsin, and if those three states had flipped, which would have taken Trump 43,000 votes to do that, he ends up winning the presidency again. And so when we talk about closeness, we're not talking about the popular vote, and we're not even talking about the eventual margin in the Electoral College, but, like, what is the margin that it would have taken to flip the Electoral College? It's a number that we looked at in 2016 when we wrote Shattered. I think a lot of Democrats felt like Hillary Clinton was pretty close to winning in 2016. Her number was over 77,000 votes to flip the three closest states. In her case, it was Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, in order for her to be president. And this idea that it was close isn't something that comes from me and Amy. It comes from our sources inside Biden's campaign, inside Trump's campaign, close observers of the political process. If you go back to election night, I think in both campaigns for a few hours on election night, they thought they were watching having deja vu from 2016. Jen O'Malley Dillon, the Biden campaign manager, late at night on election night is thinking to herself, oh, my God, what if we lose? The first campaign manager for Biden, who continued on working on the campaign even after O'Malley Dillon replaced him, walks home that night. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning. He's walking home that night thinking, how is he going to explain to the, basically to the elites of the Democratic Party, how what he's been telling them for the last few years about how Joe Biden can become president, what's he going to tell them about how he was wrong, or how he, expects that they're going to think he lied to them. This thing was on a razor's edge. A quarter of a point in one of those states, a third of a point in a second, and two-thirds of a point in a third. I mean, it's infinitesimal compared to the 158 million people who voted. So, and you saw Biden had no coattails. Republicans picked up seats in the House. Our politics are still deeply, deeply polarized. And in terms of winning Electoral College votes, not the popular vote, but in terms of winning Electoral College votes, very evenly divided.
Jonathan Allen is a senior political analyst with NBC News Digital. Amy Parnes is a senior correspondent for The Hill newspaper in Washington. The new book, Lucky, How Joe Biden Barely Won the Presidency. It is published by Crown. Jonathan, Amy, I thank you so much for your time. Be well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Again, the name of the book is Lucky. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.